Committee for February 8, 2007 will come to order. I want to talk a little bit about our agenda before we get underway. We're going to have a number of people to be heard on House Bill 2201, and so we're going to put over the public hearings on House Bill 2196 and House Bill 2388. And I apologize for those of you who may be here on those bills. It doesn't look to me between now and 10 minutes to 3 that we're going to have time to finish 2201, let alone get to those new bills. So I'd rather tell you now that we're not going to hear them rather than having you sitting here and then being disappointed at the end of the meeting. So expect those bills to be rescheduled. That's House Bill 2196 and House Bill 2388 to be rescheduled for public hearing at some later time, I'm hoping next week. We'll continue with the public hearing on House Bill 2201. Let me just say before I turn the meeting over to Mazin is that we will not hold a work session on the bill today. We need some amendments on 2201 before we can hold a work session. So although the work session's on the agenda, it won't be held today. Mazin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mazin Maddock, Legislative Revenue Office. One of the amendments that we've talked about that we've sent to Legislative Council, I've worked with the Department of Revenue on this amendment, and this basically allows the implementation date for both the tax on tobacco as well as excuse me, as well as the floor tax to be under implementation by October 1st. That's 91 days after sine die, which means that the quicker you sine die, the better you will be.
Well, the Speaker will be pleased to hear that.
And in case that doesn't happen, that will be, of course, implementation on the 1st of the next month after 90 days, which probably puts it on November 1st. And then that's basically what we have submitted to Legislative Council as the committee's wish. And they're working on it, Mr. Chair. Now, with time, of course, probably today or the end of tomorrow, you would have the amendment on the percentages of the distribution that might come as a policy choice, and then we would send that to Legislative Council to get it done. However, in order to be able to look into these issues more intently, I've put together three sheets of a lot of numbers again, and those three sheets have numbers run sequence 116, run sequence 120A, and 119A. That should be in front of you in the packet. And what these do is attempt to estimate what the impact implementation date being on October 1st. And that's the first sheet. And as we were looking yesterday, the bottom line of the numbers of how much revenue we would be looking in the 07-09 biennium, that's the last column and the absolute bottom two numbers, the two bienniums, that brings us up to about $192.4 million. And about 233, same or close number in the 09-11 biennium. The one after that, 120A, run sequence 120A, estimates it as to be 11-01 or 1st of November 2007.
Just a month later.
Yes. And this is the closest to what we were looking at yesterday with the variation on floor tax. And that would give us at this time a 182.24. And finally, run sequence 119A would be on January 1st, 2008. This is providing that it's the first day of the following quarter, as would have been under the, if you would have not adjourned by June 29th. This would bring the first biennium down to 161.7 million. So I just wanted to share these with you because you were
great.
Thank you. Asking about these.
Any questions of Mazin on these new numbers? As I understand it, this is just based on the implementation date and their revenue shift based on that. And
yes, sir.
Representative Butler.
Just one question as we come back to the issue of floor tax. The floor tax, as I understand it, would be imposed at a no different time than the actual tobacco tax. And then the second question is, are we sure of, we didn't discuss the true elasticity on OTP yesterday, particularly relative to the fact that this will bring us to the highest OTP in the nation, I understand. Any change on, I think you were using a 6% N.06?
That's true.
And you're doing that on OTP as well at the highest price in the nation?
Representative Butler, it's the 0.6 price elasticity of demand on OTP is not coupled with the population migration, if you will. And if you put them together, the actual elasticity is bigger than one, because you're increasing the price by about 11 point some percent, but you're getting a 14% reduction. So you're getting a greater than one type of elasticity. Although the increase in the OTP is higher, that same logic applies. So it is a higher elasticity, but whether we pin down the OTP, I don't know. I guess,
Mr. Chair, I expressed the concern about the E.06 on the elasticity of OTP, because nowhere does OTP carry any kind of label that was bought in Oregon, California, Utah, Wyoming, Washington, or in a smoke shop on an Indian reservation. Even in the cans of Skoal and the other smokeless tobacco, wet smokeless tobacco, none of those have any kind of a label with regard to any of the taxation. My concern is that there may be a much greater fluidity in the OTP when we move it to 95% of the wholesale, move that tax to 95% of the wholesale, where that's several percentage higher than the highest price in the nation. And with no tax stamps, my concern is that the point oh, or the E.06 might not really be the case, but I'm not going to argue with the economists on the other hand.
Thank you.
Representative Butler, sounds like you just did, but maybe not.
Well, just to explain it, Mr. Chair, cigarette packs, as everybody knows, there's a stamp on it, usually a yellow in Oregon. This is what proves that you've paid the tax. It stamps on the OTP cigars and snuff and other stuff. That rhymes, snuff and other stuff. That does not have a stamp on it. So, in essence, it is more difficult to trace, if you will, whether the tax has been properly paid in which place or which state it has been paid or not. So that's something that we could probably ask more of the administration of the tax. So that Director Hachenko is here today, and we could probably, if she gives us a chance, we could.
It does strike me, Representative, that may be a topic for a bill involving enforcement issues, the issue you raised, and I think it's a good issue. It's an important issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, we heard yesterday that the OTP, including the cigars, do not have the credit card ban on them that the tobacco, the cigarettes, packages and cartons of cigarettes have on them. Therefore, the immediate substitute for the cigarette, which is immediately roll into, these machines can roll them nearly as fast as you can pull them out of the carton anyway, it's my understanding. And so what happens is that when we no longer have the control over the immediate substitute, mm-hmm. then we have the highest price in the nation on the substitute tobacco, then my concern is that that's a very easy fix for those who would desire to go to the gray market and black market. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Thank you. I think first I'd like to hear from Elizabeth Harchenko and Tim Nesbitt from the Department of Revenue and the Governor's Office, respectively.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
While they're coming up, one quick question, if I might. Could you explain what the differences were on the 2009-2011 biennium bottom lines?
They're all slightly different.
Well, what would cause those, I should say?
They're slightly different, and they're working because of... We have a great model that says, you know, when people start giving up, it filters more with time. So the earlier you do it, the more that you lose in the future, kind of thing. So the earlier you implement the tax and you put the effect of pushing and pulling consumption, the more or less you would have in the future. It is not a static one-to-one kind of relationship.
Okay.
That's why you see differences within the 09-11 biennium.
So maybe I'm missing something, but if it were implemented later, is that consistent with the right direction?
Yeah.
That those are higher bottom line positive impacts in 2009-2011 if it's implemented later? Okay.
If I can interpret, I think what we're learning is that the earlier it's implemented, the earlier people decide to quit, and therefore the more negative impact it has on our income earlier on. The later that we implement, the later people decide to quit, and the later the impact on the revenue is. So the numbers would be larger for the later implementation dates.
Okay.
It's just anyway. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's a great question to ask because it helps to describe the model that that the economists are using to describe these numbers. Thank you. I'm going to let you three decide who
thank
goes
you,
first.
I'll go first with some overview comments. I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff for the Governor. And with me are Elizabeth Harchenko, the Director of the Revenue Department, and Reece Saylor, our Health Policy Advisor. As you know, House Bill 2201 will provide affordable health coverage to all 117,000 children in Oregon who are currently uninsured, who are less likely to get care when they need it, less likely to learn, and less likely to thrive. We won't repeat the testimony we delivered in the health policy in the health committee in the House.
Thank you. We appreciate
but
that. We're trying to limit to just
but
the tax issue.
I do think the premise of this bill bears repeating
yes.
in one sentence. We are the adults in this world. It's our obligation to help as we can to bring health care within the reach of these children and their families. Now, House Bill 2201 shows how we intend to meet that obligation, dares to say how we'll pay for it, which is what we want to talk to you about today. The proposed tax increase in House Bill 2201, we believe, should stand on its merits. We are, in effect, subsidizing smokers now by falling far short of recovering the cost to society from the use of tobacco. The handout I provided, I think I also provided to you an earlier testimony when you met as a joint committee several weeks ago. But it's pretty clear when you look at these impacts from smoking and these costs to society, to our healthcare system, to our workforce, that raising the tobacco tax is a win-win-win proposal. We recover costs, which we're currently not now covering. We reduce usage and thereby reduce healthcare costs. And we secure new resources for our healthcare system. House Bill 2201 proposes, as you heard, to raise our tobacco tax to the level in effect in Washington State, $2.025 per pack. By so doing, we'll see more smokers quit, fewer children take up the practice. You heard the numbers. 23 million fewer packs of cigarettes consumed in Oregon when this is fully implemented in a year. That means we'll save lives, we'll reduce health care costs, we'll improve workers' productivity. Plus, we'll raise approximately $180 million in new resources for our healthcare system, the bulk of which we'll be able to apply to our Healthy Kids program. And for every dollar we invest in healthcare for children and for low-income and moderate-income families, we stand to gain at least another $1.50 from the federal program for Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And those investments will pay off in greater returns, again, for healthier children who are better able to learn, more likely to grow up to become productive citizens. Now, nothing's forever, especially when it comes to the general fund, and one can look at the inflationary trends in healthcare costs now and say nothing there is sustainable either. And I'm not sure you could pick a single revenue source and match it up with what we're seeing with healthcare costs and say this is sustainable forever. That's not what we're saying. But we are saying that this is a source of revenue which is sufficient to fully fund the Healthy Kids program, the coming biennium, the following biennium, and by some projections further than that, when you look at the cost of the Healthy Kids program, even inflating it at 10% a year. Beyond that, we have the greater challenge of how we're going to meet a lot of costs in this budget, and we're not here to tell you we know what we can offer our children when this year's first graders are entering high school. But between now and then, we think we have a sustainable program, and we don't think we should let our children wait any longer for access to affordable health care. With that, we can get into the details of the revenue piece of this, and Resales is also here to answer any questions you may have about the health policies inherent in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I just wanted to give you a very brief overview of sort of the mechanics of how the department would administer these proposed increases. We administer both the cigarette tax and the other tobacco products tax. And as your staff has already told you, the way the bill is currently drafted, assuming the legislature adjourns before, I think it's July 2, the taxes would become effective October 1. And we would begin with the cigarette tax, preparing before that, developing a new stamp, and notifying retailers that they would need to take an inventory on October 1 to determine how many packs of cigarettes are past the distributor stage and out in the retail community, and to get the difference in the tax for cigarettes that are sold after that date. Other tobacco products tax is administered differently, as the discussion earlier indicated. There's not an indicator on the product. The distributor reports quarterly to the department on sales of these products into the retail chain in Oregon, and retailers are supposed to be able to produce for inspection certified documents that come from their distributors that the tax, in fact, was paid and moved through in the pricing between the distributor and the retailer. We estimated that we would need some additional resources in order to make sure that the revenue stream is sustained as much as possible, and the governor's included that in his budget. Yesterday, your staff indicated to you that there are some proposed amendments, some dash one amendments that have been drafted, and there are a couple of others that will be needed. Does the committee have the dash one amendments today? Let me walk you through those just very, very quickly and show you what the difference is between that and the bill as drafted and introduced.
Yes, it was put on the podium today, so you should have it in the pile of papers.
And I'm beginning with the tobacco or the cigarette tax, which starts at the bottom of page 8 of the printed bill. Let's start at page 9. Section 20 is the section that had the distribution percentages, and as you will note, they were blank at the time of introduction of the bill. This was partly due to the fact that until we had a revenue impact from your staff, the numbers weren't certain as to what needed to be sent where. The other issue that you've talked about is the fact that because we collect the tax through the sale of stamps and consumption is expected to be affected by a tax change, that will change the amount of dollars that will come through to the current recipients of the $1.18 that is now collected on the cigarette tax. So the draft amendments would replace Section 20 with a different Section 20 that, and as you look at the draft amendments, the dash one amendments, the first page, line six, subsection one is intended to pour into the distribution formula of the original 58 cent portion of the tax and the recipients of that 58 cents sufficient resources to cover the projected loss due to reduced consumption. Subsection 2 is intended to do that for the recipients and using the distribution system of the 60 cent portion that was added in the 1990s. And then after those two amounts are poured over into those two buckets, basically, of different distribution formulas, the remainder would be distributed 10% for tobacco use reduction and the rest into human services for the Healthy Kids Program and other health services, and the distribution there would be decided in the budget side rather than in the revenue distribution side. So that the governor's suggestion is, rather than try and adjust these percentages when we're still just projecting what the revenue stream is going to be and how consumption will change and when, to manage more of that in the budget side than in a formula. So that's the change for Section 20. We found just a typographical error on page 9, line 44, referring to the dollar amount for each stamp for 25 cigarette pack of cigarettes. And so that's fixed on page 2 of the draft amendments, line 1 of those amendments. We've also had requests for stamps of a smaller designation. There are products that are ready for marketing and are being marketed in other states of one single cigarette at a time or two cigarettes at a time. And so in anticipation of that, we're suggesting that that a stamp designation of one be provided for in the statute and the millage rate for that stamp designation in case we do need to prepare stamps for those kinds of products. On line 6 on page 2 of the draft amendments, one of the things that happens whenever we change the amount of tax that's charged on a pack of cigarettes is we do change the nature of the stamp so that it's easy for retailers, distributors, and our compliance folks to know that the new tax rate has, in fact, been paid. And we like to be able to manage the inventory of the old stamps as much as possible so there's not too much burden both in the floor tax administration and also in old stamps and new stamps being out there in the marketplace for a long period of time. So that new subsection 4 on line 6 will give us the ability to have a cutoff point after which if wholesalers have stamps they haven't used and they want to turn them back in, that we can get those back and either refund or credit or adjust a billing to a distributor. One of the other things that we need to be sure of, and this would be typical of a tax administrator, is making sure we have the money that we need in order to be able to administer what you've asked us to do. And some of you may know that when the Tobacco Task Force was initially created in 2001, before that time, administration of the cigarette tax was paid for by the general fund. When the task force was created, the legislature decided to use the revenue stream from the cigarette tax to help pay for the cost of administration and enforcement of our cigarette tax. And a sunset was put on that provision, and the sunset goes into effect at the end of this calendar year. Senate Bill 181, which has started in the other House, would pick up where that sunset leaves off and continue the funding for the task force and administration of both the cigarette and the other tobacco products taxes coming out of those revenue streams. And if that bill passes, it would not become effective until January 1, 2008. So Section 25A, which starts on line 10 of page 2 of the amendments, would cover administrative costs for the new portion of the tax for the 3 months between the effective date of the bill and January 1, 2008, when Senate Bill 181 would cover all of our expenses coming out of all portions of the tax stream. So it's a little stopgap, and it's got its own repealer. It would only apply for 3 months. The remainder of the amendments, lines 18 and 19, remove sections 27 and 28 of the bill. Those are on page 11. Those are two versions of the distribution formula for the other tobacco products tax that reflect the sunset of the payment of expenses for the task force. The governor's recommendation is that rather than try to put a redistribution table into the statute to deal with the increase in other tobacco products tax, that using the current distribution formula will allow the budget process to be the mechanism for allocating funds so that we don't have to try and guess how much, what percent needs to be distributed to each of the four areas, given that it is really difficult, as the earlier discussion indicated, to know exactly what the interplay between cigarette tax consumption and other tobacco products consumption is going to be over time. It gives the legislature more flexibility to deal with things happening differently than really the very best work of your economists can predict. So the what would be retained would be the distribution, which is about 41.5% of the other tobacco products tax receipts going into the Oregon Health Plan, about 4.6% going toward tobacco use reduction, and the remainder staying in the general fund and just continuing to use that same distribution formula for the increased other tobacco products tax. So that's the scope of those amendments. And as I said, on page 1, the two percentages, line 6 and line 10, probably will need to be adjusted to correspond with the revenue impact report that's been given to you. And there will probably be an amendment that clarifies that if we don't make October 1, that November 1 is the date for which the new taxes would first apply. I'd be happy to answer any questions on those amendments.
Okay. Questions for this panel?
Representative Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Harshenko, I guess I want to start with you because I got a series of questions. Currently, right now, the elderly and disabled receive 2% from the income, the revenue from the tax on cigarettes, is what I understand. And that equates to about 2.2 cents a pack. Boiling down, that's about $8 million. My question, as I've said that now, is will they be held harmless should the revenue decrease?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, the intent of the amendments is to hold harmless those recipients up from the current tax, which includes cities and counties, elderly and disabled transportation, I believe, is the category, the Oregon Health Plan, to continue to have those programs receive the amount of dollars that they would have received if the tax amount had not been changed, and hold them harmless from consumption shifts, which would reduce the amount that they would receive if the amendments weren't approved. So okay. It's the dash one amendments, lines 6 through 13, that attempt to do that, hold harmless for those programs.
Okay. Thank you. I'll stop right there.
You didn't have the other questions?
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm just going to wait. Just wait for a moment.
Okay. All right. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, you've indicated that the costs, the tobacco costs will cover the private health care options that are being discussed here in this, even with 23 million fewer packs. And that's based upon something in the vicinity of between, we've been given a run today from number 116 through 119A of between 192 million and 161.7 million. Is that still your opinion today, that this will be sufficient to take care of the needs of the Oregon Health Plan's needs under this for the private health option program account?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, we're talking about the Healthy Kids program looking out into future biennia. Yes, we do believe that when we match up those costs to what will be a fairly steady and predictable stream of revenue, as you saw in the charts yesterday, it's a flat line, but it's also pretty stable and predictable.
Okay, I'm having trouble comparing, Mr. Chair. I don't know what the Healthy Kids, nowhere in my bill does it say Healthy Kids here on the summary. Which is it? Is it the private health option program?
May I help? The Healthy Kids program.
Would you identify yourself for the record? Thank you.
For the record, I'm Lee Saylor. I'm health policy advisor to Governor Kornblosky. The Healthy Kids program actually consists of a grouping of things. Some of it is adding kids into our existing Oregon Health Plan. Some of it is providing subsidies to children who have coverage offered through their employer and helping their families afford to pay their part of that. And some of it is this new health insurance product that is called out in the bill, too, which would be designed and available to those over 200% of poverty level and on up through as far as you can go on a sliding scale basis. And yes, the funds in the revenues that come from the tobacco tax are sufficient to cover all three of those aspects of the program.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I just need some help.
Yes, sir.
Having trouble with which is the Healthy Kids program. Is it must be part of the private health option program account. It must be part of the Oregon Health Plan set aside. It must be, it probably isn't the TURA account, the tax tobacco use reduction account, but it then must be part of the Department of Human Services physician and health care provider reimbursement rate increase.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if you look at the Dash 1 amendments, I think it's probably easier to work from the Dash 1s on this. And line 17 through 23, as Ms. Arshenko described earlier, show you what happens to the new money once we've held harmless the other distribution pots of tobacco receipts. So we're taking 10% of the new money for tobacco use reduction, and the remaining 90%, as you see, is continuously appropriated to the Department of Human Services to fund the Oregon Healthy Kids program with those three components that Ms. Saylor just described, and to fund other health services provided by the department. In the initial years, we have enough revenue to fund other health services. In the out years, more of that revenue will go to sustain Healthy Kids.
Okay. So if I can follow up.
Let me work on this just for a second, see if I can help. The reference in the amendment is to Section 2 of the bill. And if you look at Section 2 of the bill on page 1, line 11, through page 2, line 9, you'll get a list of all the aspects of the Oregon Healthy Kids program as they're defined in the bill. Now, we're stuck with looking at that program in order to explain the way the tax is divided up. But this is the part of the bill that the earlier committee spent so much time on and that we're hoping not to spend very much time on ourselves. I can tell you that there are ongoing conversations taking place on this bill that may have some impact on the actual makeup of this section of the bill, but this gives you a good outline of where we are today, at least looking at House Bill 2211 or 2201, Section 2, right there under your hand, and that gives you a pretty good list of what's contained in the Oregon Healthy Kids program. as it and of course it's referred to in the amendment on line 21 on the first page of that amendment. I think that's what you're referring to.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative Butler. If it doesn't, would you try to ask it again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make absolutely certain that we've got new runs that amount to as much as $20 million just in the first year. And my concern is we're receiving testimony that this will be sufficient for the program as it is now, and it will be sufficient for into the future sometime, but I'm concerned that Mr. Nesbitt indicated that even with 10% inflation, this bill covers the health care costs into the future. Okay, and so my next question is, and perhaps that's for the health care specialist here, is how much of health care costs been increasing? Have they been going up 10% or less?
Well, they've actually had a trend to go up slightly higher, but they are dropping. The rate of increase has been dropping recently. It's a cyclical curve, and we have seen a slight downturn in the trend recently. So that's probably a very realistic and, if anything, maybe over supposed rate of increase.
So, Mr. just a clarification. So,
Representative Butler,
this flow of funds anticipate that healthcare costs in the state of Oregon will increase at 10% or less into the future.
In over the next several biennia, correct. Okay.
Then, Mr. Chair, I don't want to get into necessarily the amounts of money it takes to do each of the various things, because you said that had been slogged out in another session, but I think I would like to know how much of this, particularly if we go just today, we've looked at the difference between $162 million and $192 million. Mm-hmm. $30 million goes a long ways in Eastern Oregon. That would run most every small county budget in much of Eastern Oregon. So, right. When we give estimates that vary in that amount, yeah. I like to kind of pin them down, particularly if we're expected to vote in revenue, that this is sufficient. And then I just don't want the rug pulled out from underneath tens of thousands of young people who think they have insurance at December 31st in 2009 and find out in 2010 they don't.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have a response to that question? I think what he's asking is, what's this program actually going to cost?
We can give you the more detailed calculations, Mr. Chair and Representative. But we have an estimate of $78.7 million in the first biennium, which would leverage an additional $78 million in federal dollars. But when we get to a full biennium...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I need a clarification on that. Tim's earlier comment was that we get a dollar and a half from feds. So is it 78, we get 78, or 78, we get 120?
I think my testimony was for every dollar we put into the program for low-income and moderate-income families, we'll get that $1.50. When we go beyond some of the eligible groups that are currently eligible to receive matching funds from the feds, we would be using our own general fund dollars.
General fund or tobacco use?
I'm sorry, tobacco dollars.
Okay.
Unmatched. And if I can continue on, in the 2009 and 11 biennium, we would see a cost approaching $200 million, right at $200 million by our estimate, for the Healthy Kids program. And that would be comparing to something like $210 to $215 million net of the Hold Harmless and the education and prevention monies, the 10% in the 09-11 biennium. And Dr. Goldberg has done other calculations, which I don't know if he's back in the room yet. He had to leave earlier, but we can get from his office, or Ms. Sailors can forward to you the component calculation.
I think it might be helpful if we had a chart that sort of gave an estimate of just these items and just the expenses on these items, the Healthy Kids Program and TURA, the Tobacco Use Prevention and Education piece, as it's currently projected by the eggheads who figure these things out. That, I think, would be helpful to the committee so we can compare those numbers against the revenue numbers, and I hope that would be useful to...
Mr. Chair, that would be very useful. I think that's really the only responsible thing for us to do.
Right.
If we're expected in this committee to say, yes, it's enough, it's sufficient, you won't dip into your general funds. Yes, it's sufficient, and the federal funds will come to match at 1.5 times or at 1 time, depending upon where you're spending them. Then I think we really need to have that, particularly in light of the kind of the fluidity we've been looking at, and the possibility that maybe the OTP may not gin up as much money as we thought.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the comment. I should note, and I don't know if I told the committee this before, that this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means that is routinely working on exactly that set of issues as they deal with all budgets and budget matters. Representative Gelser, you've been trying to get in here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Mr. Chair, I had the opportunity to serve with Representative Bruin in the Health Committee where we heard this, and we had some of these conversations around sustainability and cost. And one of the things that was very helpful to me was being able to distinguish and understand the programs that are specifically in House Bill 2201, separate from some of those other programs that have been talked about as a larger package of serving kids. And I think it would be very helpful because once I saw that, became very convinced that this is a very sustainable program which expands coverage to our OHP Plus population, allows kids to buy into a private health product by either paying a premium on a sliding fee scale, and that's what compromises healthy kids in House Bill 2201. So if we could get that graphically, maybe as Representative Butler described, to show us very specifically what it is in House Bill 2201, I think that could address some of those questions, and it's certainly what made me very confident that this is not just a good plan, it's also very sustainable.
Thank you, Representative. And if I misspoke, that's exactly what I was asking for. the things that are just in the bill, not anything else. Thank you. Was there something else, Representative Gelser?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add
yes,
one thing.
Sir.
I think, I don't know if Ms. Harchenko confirmed this, but given the new estimates of revenues from LRO staff, we're right on the mark, aren't we not? In your calculations.
Well, Mr. Chair, for purposes of putting the governor's budget together, we had to make some assumptions and did confer with staff on the proposals. And so the governor's budget assumed that there would be a backfill for the current recipients so that they would be held harmless from a consumption change, and that there would be, I believe, $181.7 million that would actually come in during this biennium to and would get through us and to the Department of Human Services in order to fund the activities that are to be funded, and the governor's budget actually distributes those dollars. And I can't say that I remember exactly what the assumptions were that were made for budget purposes for 2009-11, and because that would be a 24-month period as opposed to the 21 months that we assumed. But at this point, I think the way the governor's budget, the assumptions that were made in the governor's budget, did attempt to be conservative and that they line up reasonably well with the estimates that you have.
Right. Thank you, and of course, the point you make is well taken. If if our revenue estimates are right, and the tax becomes effective on November 1st, we're within $1 million of the number that you used as your estimate. If the tax becomes effective October 1st, because we've managed to make a minor amendment to the bill, and we managed to get out of the building on time, on the time that the Speaker and the President have told us they want to get out of the building. We actually raised about $11 million more than the amount you estimated because the tax goes into effect a month earlier. Something further on this point?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just one follow-up with Director Harchenko, and that is the administration of the Tobacco Tax Task Force, which is only a short period of time, I recognize. Number one, do you have any, and that'll be slogged out down on Ways and Means, but number two, do you have any idea as to how that will amount in relationship to the 182 or 192 or 161 that we'll be raising? And are you confident that we're going? I'm particularly anxious about not the stamps. I think you've got all of, that's mostly Meyercord, I think. But I'm particularly anxious about the floor tax, the administration of the floor tax, particularly with all the retailers, tens of thousands of places to buy tobacco in the state of Oregon. And then I'm concerned about the OTP as well, Elizabeth.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the governor's budget allocates $1.7 million of the new revenue to the task force, in addition to the what are they calling it now, essential budget level for the task force continuing from this current biennium. And we felt that with that additional amount of revenue to fund the activities of, for administration and enforcement, that we could have a reasonable chance to sustain this revenue stream, assuming that nothing comes over the wall that we can't anticipate. So we're doing much better on internet sales than we were 2 years ago due to the efforts of the Attorney General's office. We are monitoring very carefully other tobacco products distribution and legitimate and illegitimate, and there's also a lot of work that's being done by the state police and the Department of Justice to try to make sure that the illegal stream of other tobacco products is kept to an absolute minimum. So there's always risk, particularly when you get to the point of a major price increase. But we think we'll be ready to monitor and manage that, and also just monitor the revenue stream and report back regularly with Legislative Fiscal Office on how the revenues are coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's there's a significant comfort level in that process, but I'm also aware that what will happen is the day before the tax actually takes effect, sales will probably never be that high in the history of the state of Oregon before or since or after. And that means that there is a rather significant flow of tobacco that's been unstamped that day before that's moved out in a huge number of directions. And my concern is, as it always is with regard to a floor tax, whether it's on tobacco or on a new gallon of gasoline at a new tax rate, it's just how do we administer that and make sure that we, you know, the folks, the bad actors are pulled in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's one of the reasons why we asked for the amendment about controlling the inventory of old stamps. So we are aware of that issue that you're concerned about and are going to be watching and monitoring that as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
And we'll have the expenditure detail to you by tomorrow.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. So what do we got here? Let's see. We have three from yesterday. Okay. Is Ellen Lowe from Children First here today? She was here. She signed up yesterday. And okay. Kathy Kaufman? Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were going to do yesterday's list first, but you're representing the same organization. Go ahead.
Thank you.
And before you begin, I should say we're limiting our testimony to issues having to do with the tax and issues relating to the cost of cigarettes and things of that sort. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Kathy Coughlin. I'm the Policy Director for Children First for Oregon. We are a widely respected statewide nonprofit, nonpartisan child advocacy organization. We've been working in the state for over 15 years. I'm here to say that we believe the tobacco tax is the most sensible way to fund the Healthy Kids program. The costs of tobacco use are staggering, as you've heard in previous testimony. In 2002, over 7,000 lives were lost and more than $1 billion spent on direct medical costs. Tobacco tax enables us to recoup more of these costs than we currently do. It will save some of these lives, and it will fund what should be all of our number one priority, health care for all of Oregon's children. The tobacco tax also supports child health beyond funding the Healthy Kids program. Studies show increasing the cost of cigarettes is very effective in preventing the number of kids who go from experimenting to becoming regular addicted smokers. Our current way of doing business is unsustainable, and we believe you're responsible. We recover nearly a fraction of the cost of tobacco use, and we pay the highest price for uninsured kids to receive the lowest quality of care in the emergency room. The health of Oregon's children cannot wait. The tobacco tax provides us with a way to fund health care for all of Oregon's kids now, and it will save us money in the long run by decreasing the direct costs of smoking-related disease. And just in conclusion, we believe that House Bill 2201 provides lawmakers with a choice, the choice to either protect tobacco interests or protect the welfare of our children. And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know you all are committed to the well-being of Oregon's kids, and we urge you to support House Bill 2201. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Mr. Representative Butler. Perhaps not for Kathy Coughlin, but certainly Children First of Oregon have access to a huge database, but maybe for staff and somebody from the Oregon Health Statistics, DHS, but do we actually know the cost of tobacco on Oregon residents on an annual basis now? I think in line with what Representative Broome was asking yesterday, that, you know, is there a break-even point at which tobacco, you know, where you start making less money, bringing in less money? Is there a point at which, you can sell all the tobacco you can bring into the state? Is there a point at which tobacco should be taxed to actually say this is the cost of tobacco consumption in Oregon? If that's $2.02 a pack, or if it's $22.02 a pack, is there a way to calculate that number? Kathy, do you have that number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't say for sure. I would be happy to very promptly get that information to you, but what I have heard is $11 per pack is what the cost to Oregonians is.
Thank you.
So just to clarify, if we had a tax of $11 a pack, that would cover the cost of tobacco-related health care to the state and the federal government, or in general?
Mr. Chair, and again, this is just my understanding, and I will have to verify and get the information to the committee after this, but my understanding is the $11 per pack is what the cost is to that's particular to Oregon, and of course, that cost doesn't pay for the people whose lives are lost. It simply pays for the cost of their illness and the loss of their productivity.
Thank you.
Madison, what's the elasticity? $11.
Fortunately, that question is not in front of it. Representative Broome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to Representative Butler, we're looking at two questions here. One is, truly, what is the cost of smoking on the public health system? Just for the committee's benefit, I have a request, an LC right now. I do not have the LC back, but it's in there, which would ask the Department of Human Services to work with the governor's office and the various county health officials to try to determine on a new basis what truly the cost of smoking is on the public health system in Oregon. But that's just one of the questions. Mm-hmm. Because, I'm sure Mazin could argue, you know, if it is 10 or 12 or 15, whatever it is, you get to a certain point, and if you're charging $15 per pack of cigarette, you're not going to recover any of the cost of smoking on the public health system because nobody's going to buy cigarettes in Oregon. So the second question is, what is the maximum tax? And this is where I was trying to go yesterday with this question. What is the maximum tax rate you can charge a pack of cigarettes before you start losing revenue? I mean, there's going to be an inflection point at some point. Only hindsight usually knows what that is. But so I just throw that out there.
That would be an interesting study.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, lucky for us that we had a prohibition type of arrangement in the 20s, so we could actually look at that and see.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's go ahead and we'll finish up with yesterday's list first. If they're here, Stephen Rowe and John Charles. Are either of those gentlemen?
Stephen Rowe?
They're both here. Okay. Mr. Rowe, you're not part of a panel. Why don't you go first? And
Chairman Barnhart, committee, it's a pleasure to be here today to talk to my partners in business, because you truly are my partners in business. Presently, when I sell a product, you collect more money than I collect. So you are my partners. I'm the owner of two retail tobacco shops. Actually, one is on hiatus right at the moment. We sell premium cigars. We sell pipe tobacco. We sell roll-your-own tobacco. We really are not a cigarette shop that's relegated to convenience marts and specialty outlets that are run by out-of-state interests. We are a small business. A number of years ago, 5-6 years ago, we came in successfully after three legislative sessions, got our cigar tax passed, capped at 50 cents on our premium cigars. That changed our market tremendously. We were able to, I now pay 2.5 to 3 times as much tobacco tax on my cigars because my customers are buying in-state instead of from out-of-state suppliers. Specifically, with regards to this bill and the increase in the cigarette tax and tobacco tax, I find it a challenge to think how we can look ahead to fund our health care from a single source, any single source of tax revenue, and in particular to burden the cigarette and smokers. I mean, I understand there's a cost for the health care, but these also happen to be the poorest in general, the poorest people in our state. So there is a cost associated with it. I would caution further, based upon Representative Butler's comments and the previous testimony with regards to the makeup costs. The testimony that was provided yesterday by the legislative revenue staff showed a 14% reduction number of PACs. And if you're going to make up the amount of dollars that are being lost, that amounts to $66 million over a biennium in 2009 to 2011, based upon my quick calculations in the back of the room. That reduces that $220 million down to probably around $160 million. The reality is, in the past, we've seen that declining the Oregon-Washington tax stance. We'll probably see a greater decrease in the number of packs sold, particularly as that tax increases to a much higher level, that we will find people finding different ways to get cigarettes from out of state. Representative Butler, you're close to the state of Idaho, where the tax is fairly low on cigarettes. I have heard anecdotal stories from customers who've walked in and said, I used to travel overnight, buy a carton or two for myself. Now I come back with a trunk load for all my friends. And that is impossible to enforce, just impossible to enforce when people drive across the border to Idaho and come back with a trunk load of cigarettes. You're just not going to stop everybody at the border and search their cars. I would like to offer specific comments with regards to, make sure I've got the right section, section 20, my notes are all over here from Washington. With regards to the other tobacco product taxes, the increase of going from 65% to 95% on loose tobaccos, pipe tobaccos, roll your own tobaccos, will chase more customers out of state. That revenue will go down. Brought for an example today, three versions of pipe tobacco, which pipe tobacco is a fairly small piece of the market. This is a tin tobacco. This is a prepackaged tobacco, and this is a bulk tobacco that we buy and we sell by the typically by the ounce. This happens to be 2 ounces. This is about an ounce and a half, and this is an ounce and a half. The way the tax structure is set up, each of those are taxed on the wholesale cost. And as you can tell, we've got packaging differences here which drive up the price on it. When I take a look at the three, I'll give you a relative idea. Under the current tax system, this product sells for about $14.50 for about an ounce and a half of tobacco. This one sells for about $7, and this one sells for about $4 for 2 ounces. The reason is we're paying tax on packaging. The reality is we don't sell this product. People don't buy it in-state. They buy it from out-of-state suppliers. They buy it across the Internet. Similarly for this, this is going disappearing. Most of the places that have carried this have been grocery stores, convenience stores. They're no longer carrying it because it's just too much of a headache for a small piece of the market. This is disappearing. We're continuing to sell this, but as the tax continues to go up, this is going to go down as well. And in the end, pipe tobacco will be a very, very small piece of the tobacco tax. So we would urge you to reconsider increasing that tax by from 65 to 95%. It's already at a fairly steep level, if you will. When I look at these three products as far as the taxes on them, this has a tax level that amounts to 50, under the new tax system, $52 a pound. $52. When I come down to this one, we're down in the range of $18 to $20 a pound. So we pay a fairly stiff tax already on this tobacco, on a tobacco product, for a product which, by the health studies, show it has a very relatively benign effect for the user of that particular product. So in conclusion, I strongly urge you to take a real close look at the OTP. I know it's a blend of various products, but I know for these products, this market will continue to disappear. These people will go out of state because the Internet is there and they can access it at any time. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Rowe? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just Stephen, thank you for this testimony. My concern continues to be with the OTP tax going from 65 to 95 cents, that would force us up. Have you looked at the competition nationwide? Because that would put us at the high, it's my understanding that puts us at the highest OTP tax in the nation, which is going to affect your cigars. Your cigars now at the, well, at the small cigars.
The
not
small
your,
cigars.
Not your premium cigar, but your small cigars, are actually, and I think I received some information about the internet sales and the prices. And so my concern is probably primarily with regard to a specialty tobacco store. Are you prepared to pay the floor tax? Mr. Chair, the reason I'm concerned about this is I received an email yesterday, last evening, from a small wholesale tobacco company, and the last session our revenue committee went out and visited this small one warehouse. It's a one-room warehouse. The estimated cost of just the floor tax in that one building room was $395,000 plus, and they just said we don't have that kind of money that we can afford to go ahead and do that, so we've got to run that down. My concern is for a small tobacconist, when you look around and say, okay, everything that's here, basically that we paid the 65 cent tax on, we're going to pay that half again as much with the 95 cents. And then the other comment that was made in this email that I received from these folks was that the security and the insurance costs that they're going to be faced with now is going to be significantly greater because they have folks that are delivering. When you're delivering, used to be that you could deliver three of the cases of the cartons. Now they have to, under security, deliver a case at a time. So my question is, what does it look like for you to be able to pay to go out and raise the tax or raise the cash overnight that you'll have to pay on the OTP, on inventory?
Personally, on OTP, it's the primary share of our business is in premium cigars, which is capped at the 50 cents, so that part of our inventory would not be hit. It was, for example, California just recently voted down and a significant increase in their OTP tax. It would have taken their cigar tax from 54% to 145 or 150%, and there were a number of comparable businesses in California were looking at a $100,000 tax bill, and they were ready to go out of business, basically. I can see, particularly for distributors who deal in the low end of the market, the Swisher Sweets and so on, they will have a significant floor tax, which could very well put them out of business. They're the primary suppliers for the convenience stores and grocery stores and so on. So it's going to be a major thing, major issue. Personal situation, just because of where our market is, there's going to be an impact, but it's not a major impact because that's not the market we play in.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, would you like staff to do personal experimentation and research? For
I'm going to guess, Mr. Chair, that the one can that Mr. Eisler show, or Mr. Rowe showed us here, that one can probably will not show up on his OTP 30 cent more tax, because if he's not selling any of it, he's going to want to try and run it out the door in a hurry. So, Mazin, you may want to catch him at the door before he heads out.
Before he gets out. Thank you very much.
For experimentation.
Yes. Scientific.
Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles. I'm president of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a research and educational center in Portland, and we are interested in policies promoting individual liberty, economic opportunity, and personal responsibility. As part of our work, we sometimes have to, we're happy actually to stand up for oppressed political minorities on matters of principle, and there are a few political minorities more oppressed in Oregon than tobacco users, who have, for about a decade been or more, been used as human piñatas by legislators who just want to bang them with sticks and take up all the money. And I want to move right to the heart of this problem, and I hope you have an outline of my brief remarks, as well as a longer paper we wrote a while back entitled Tobacco Revenues Prove Addictive, which addresses the most problematic new addiction in Oregon, which is legislative addiction to gambling and liquor and tobacco revenues. All of these taxes, and especially the tax in this bill in front of you, pose a moral hazard problem. Excuse me. By using this as a finance measure, legislators are clearly stating they want Oregonians to buy as many cigarettes as possible, as if it's some kind of patriotic duty to buy cigarettes to fund this allegedly noble purpose that's in the policy part of the bill that we won't talk about today. And but those two purposes are mutually incompatible. You're either in it for the money, in which case you make no pretense of public health concerns, you're just in it for the money, or you're in it as a way of suppressing cigarette smoking, and as the previous witness, the woman who was up here from the other group, said, you know, tobacco taxes can, in fact, reduce the amount of actual smoking, and that's the typical public health rationale for this. And, in fact, I have a little news clip here from February of 2002 when then-candidate Kulongoski was taking heat for criticizing then-Governor Kitzhaber's modest 30-cent per pack tax increase. According to Jeff Mapes, who wrote it, Kulongoski questioned whether the tax would raise much revenue because higher cigarette prices would discourage consumption. But raising the tax to discourage consumption would be fine, he said. So it's very clearly you're either in it to discourage consumption, and if that's the case, then whatever revenue comes should be put somewhere that you don't actually need to rely on it, because if you're trying to discourage consumption, you should hope to discourage it to zero and therefore has zero revenue. And as a lifelong non-smoker, I'd be thrilled if, in fact, consumption went to zero. I mean, I don't really have a dog in the race in terms of what I personally buy, but there's a moral hazard question. What's the purpose? You can't do both things. Now, as a previous witness has said, smokers are disproportionately poor and less educated. They're also disproportionately tend to come from minority groups. And so they are the least able to defend themselves from the predations of a punitive majority, as is the case with this bill. A drastic rise in the excise tax will obviously encourage prohibition-style tax evasion, smuggling, and violence. And lest you think I'm just engaging in hyperbole, as recently as 2004, in New York City, where tobacco taxes are it's absurd in terms of state, city, local, there's a very thriving black market economy. In 2004, there were at least four known homicides related to the tobacco smuggling trade. When you make it lucrative enough, you invite a criminal element, and when it's a black market economy, the usual method for settling disputes is not to hire lawyers and mediators. It's to kill people or engage in violence. You're encouraging the rise of the black market economy if you actually do this. In my view, the only policy rationale for tobacco tax of any type is to reimburse the state or private parties for uncompensated health costs, healthcare costs associated with smoking. And when I say uncompensated, that does not mean, well, if someone smokes and they kill themselves gradually over time, that's a cost that someone has to be borne through a tax. If you kill yourself, that is a cost. And the reason there's no agreed-upon methodology to address a question raised previously, well, what's this externality cost? In our paper here, we reference costs going from $4 a pack to 12 dollars and change because there is no agreed-upon methodology, because there is no agreed-upon definition of what is the external cost of smoking. These all involve value judgments. But we guessed in our paper that probably 25 cents a pack, especially if you net out the fact that people who die younger from smoking are not going to collect Medicare and Social Security, and therefore they're saving people money, we're well beyond the point where we should be collecting for uncompensated costs from smokers. So my final point really is, if subsidizing health care is worth doing, it's worth doing with revenue generated through a progressive income tax that we all pay. And if you're not willing to do that, then alternatively, there's lots of other revenue floating around, especially through the master settlement agreement, the big tobacco tax litigation, which in the mid-1990s, when the 46 attorney generals, including Oregon, sued against the tobacco companies, they piously said this was all about the uncompensated health care issue for the states. And then as soon as they got the money, most states immediately started using the money for things that have nothing to do with health care. And you can see here the last 4 years, early on, Oregon did, this is all from the GAO reports that are published annually, early on, 2002, education in the Oregon health care plan was a big recipient of MSA money. Okay, there's sort of a logical nexus there. That's all declined in the last 2 years. Debt service on securitized funds? What's the nexus between smokers and paying off bonds? Or, for that matter, you could take money from the existing tax.
Mr. Charles, yeah. We're getting a little bit of field from the bill. And what we wanted to do was to limit our conversation today to matters involving the tax portion of the bill and the effects that would have. And now we're talking about the tobacco settlement agreement. I'd like to, because we have limited time and several other witnesses to hear from, I'd like to bring us back to talking about the topic for today. And if you would do that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I'll just close by saying the MSA, that is a tax. And so you already have a revenue stream that you can use in lieu of any tax increase in this bill.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Questions? Let's start on the end with Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. You referenced that you're concerned about the individuals who would unfairly share the burden of the tax and indicated that smokers tend to be among the poorest that are among us. Do you have any statistics that would point to what the rate of the insurance of access to health insurance and health care is for the children of smoking Oregonians?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I don't have information off the top of my head, no.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you.
Do you think that given that one of the goals of this program is to provide access to health insurance for uninsured kids who would tend to be kids that would come from lower income brackets, and given that you've pointed out that these are the poorest people in our communities and in testimony in the other committee among the sickest, and that secondhand smoke causes children to become sicker, might not these families be among those that will benefit the most from this tax, both by the reduction in their smoking and the extension of health care benefits to their children who are directly suffering the impact of secondhand cigarette smoke in their households?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, I'm sure there are children in those families that would benefit, but I don't think they're going to benefit by also being harmed by their parents having to pay what I view as a punitive tax when things like food stamps we pay for out of general fund revenues that helps those families. I think if this is worth doing, if it's in the public interest, it's worth doing with general fund dollars. It's more progressive, in my view, much more progressive.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your testimony, you said that you thought the logical implication of what this bill proposed to do was to encourage people to smoke more. And I would just ask you to think about what we have been doing, which is we've reduced taxes on tobacco products. And you probably know this, but the result of that seems to have been exactly what you're suggesting, which is people are smoking more, and not just people, but young people in particular, and that includes pregnant women. So what do you think? I mean, how is this working currently in a way that's at all helpful, according to your analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, my point is, if you're planning to fund a policy program from a revenue source, if you fund, say, through a property tax, you're hoping that through economic activity, a property tax revenues will rise over time and fund it. Same with income. So if you're funding a policy program through a cigarette tax, inherently you're hoping that will be a stable and probably increasing revenue source, which means the message you're sending is you want people to buy cigarettes. I think that's a morally untenable message just for legislators to be sending.
But follow up, Mr. Chair. It seems quite the opposite to me, that what the testimony we've been hearing is that some of what happens, and the staff has already showed us that, is that we see people smoking less when the price of cigarettes goes up. So I'm not sure I see the moral dilemma that you see. Well, it seems like what we're doing is trying to do something good and also discourage a behavior that's not very healthy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I hope you're right, and I hope, therefore, that if this goes into effect, smoking will drop to zero. That means you have a revenue problem.
If that were the case. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. That doesn't seem to be the way it usually works out, though.
Well, anything that you tax, if you tax it at a higher rate, it is likely to you see less of it. So you can't escape this dilemma here.
Thank you.
And just a final follow-up, Representative Rosenbaum. So if that's true, then we're also having less of the ill health consequences, and therefore we're reducing the cost to the state by reducing the behavior that causes all these health problems, right?
President Rosenbaum, if your point is that if smoking decreases, you would have less health care costs associated with smoking, that's certainly true. But most of the people who would potentially benefit from the policy part of this bill, so say kids, are probably not smokers, so you're still going to have the revenue problem funding that. And a higher taxation rate is unlikely, especially if it's only moderately higher, you don't have the smuggling evasion problem. If it's massively higher, as this gentleman and others have pointed out, you're actually going to make this a very infeasible revenue source that defeats the policy part of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gelser? No? Representative Butler?
Thank you. John, I assume you're an economist. I believe that's your background.
No, sir, I'm not an economist.
Okay, well, I think there's an adage that says that in economics that you tax that activity which you wish to discourage.
Right.
And so I want to get to the point, your number 5 point on your, well, it isn't either, I'm sorry, it's number 3 point on your bullets here. The rise in the excise tax will encourage prohibition-style evasion, smuggling, and violence. If we were to have a tax that said that we would tax tobacco at a rate that the economists thought that it was going to cost us to address all of the health issues that they tell us that are associated with the consumption, whether it be first-hand or second-hand smoking and or other uses of tobacco, then I assume that's what New Jersey and New York City and New York have attempted to do and putting these super high taxes. Have they in any way had a tremendous downturn in the way that tobacco is consumed, the amounts of tobacco in their societies, or are they just bringing it in on the black market through these violent gangs and smuggling trades?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, ultimately that's an unknowable. The answer is unknowable. You don't anything is just an estimate, but they do know clearly because tax rates have been so high, and they're high just for money purposes, not because the legislatures cared about health issues. Clearly, they saw a huge rise in black market economy. Well, by its nature, it's very difficult to get data about activities that people engage in that don't want to report.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Charles? Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Okay. I have three more people on my list for today. We have about 7 minutes. Among the three of you, is there somebody, either any of the three of you, unable to come back tomorrow? Come forward, if you would.
I'm Jeffrey Fellows.
Yeah.
From
Kaiser, yes.
I'm at the Center for Health Research.
Thank you. Dr. Fellows, go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Fellows. I'm a health economist and investigator from Kaiser Permanente's Center for Health Research in Portland, Oregon. My research focuses on assessing the health and economic costs of tobacco use and evaluating tobacco cessation interventions in large populations. The testimony I'm going to give today is based upon my research and the research in the public field out there, and doesn't necessarily represent the views of Kaiser Permanente. I'm honored to have the opportunity to provide expert testimony regarding the effects of the tobacco tax increase. As you probably have heard so far, the increasing taxes on cigarettes is one of the most effective methods for reducing smoking rates and the adverse health effects, health and economic consequences of smoking. Studies show that increasing the purchase price of a pack of cigarettes by 10% will lead to an average of 4% decline in adult cigarette consumption. Among poor populations and minorities, that rate is higher, so you'll get a more than a 4% increase in or decline in consumption. And about half of that decline is prevalence, people quitting. The other half is people reducing the amount that they smoke. For youth, about 7% consumption decline will be achieved for every 10% increase in price. So the youth who are currently smoking are much more price sensitive than adults are on average. One of the things that
just to make sure that I understand, yes, your written testimony says that it actually reduces consumption among youth by 14%. And smoking rates by 7%. Does that mean that 7% fewer youth would take up smoking at all? Is that what you're referring to, or is it something else?
I think that paragraph 3, mm-hmm, talks about what would happen with in the state of Oregon, and I think what you've done here is go to the 18.5%, which is what I assumed was the smoking rate, with a 4.1% decline in consumption, or 4.1% decline in adult smoking. And for youth, I think the tax increase would expect to reduce consumption by 14.2%. I'm assuming that there's about a 20% increase in price as a result of the 84-cent tax increase. And so you get about a 14% decline in youth consumption. And about half of that would be smoking, that teens would be quitting, made up of teens quitting. So that's the focus here, and what I wanted to do was estimate, given the decline in adult smoking, particularly the consumption, the impact on tax revenues, which looking at reviewing the data that you had and discussed earlier, what I had produced in the table is fairly similar. And what you see is that on page 4, or I'm sorry, it's, I think it's page 2 for you. It's page 4 for me for my notes here. You see on the table there that I compared a $2.02 tax with a $1.18 tax. And what I estimated between 2008 and 2012, during that time, that total revenues would increase by about $550 million, $560 million. And I'm presuming that there's a continuation. In both cases, I'm assuming that there's about nearly a two pack per capita decline in consumption as a secular trend. So that you'll see this small decline in cigarette consumption over the years, regardless of whether or not you raise the tax or not. And so that's included. And what I noticed about these data is that they're fairly close to what you were reviewing earlier today. And I don't want to get hung up on numbers because the numbers can change based upon small variations in assumptions. But the idea is that this is from this study here, this analysis, is that there's going to be a substantial increase in revenues, net revenues for the state. and that will be a very consistent increase, and it'll stay high over several years. And one of the most important results also of that tax is that if we do get a 4% decline for every 10%, and assuming again that this is going to produce about a 20% increase in price, that we should get about an 8% decline in consumption and about 4%, a little bit more, decline in the first year in prevalence, that could be that would equal more than 20,000 new quitters. One of the main aspects of my work is over the last few years has been to develop estimates of the return on investment from smoking cessation for health plans and employers. And so I've developed a model, and some of the details are there. And what I did is adapted that model to assess what the near-term effects on healthcare costs and productivity would be for those 20,000 new quitters. And based upon my analysis, total savings in Oregon could equal over $160 million in reduced health care and productivity costs after 5 years. And those cost savings are discounted to the present value so that in $2004 dollars. If the tax ends up having an equivalent effect on consumption and smoking that it had in the 1996 change, we will see a much greater savings. There'll be slightly lower increase in net revenues. Net revenues for the same period would probably go down about $340 million net increase from the $559 million. But there'd be about 50,000 people who would quit. And that 50,000 reduction in smoking could produce well over $400 million over the next 5 years in savings for health plans and health care expenditures and productivity losses. Now, the figures, again, are not meant to be precise predictions of what's going to happen, because the actual results will differ. Based on what happens, every time this happens, it will get new data. But the implications are clear. Net revenues will increase as consumption decreases, and the level will remain stable for many years. Higher prices will prompt thousands of smokers to quit, leading to substantial savings in health care and productivity costs. For these reasons, increasing the excise tax on cigarettes makes economic sense. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Fellows. Are there questions for Dr. Fellows? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a compelling reason why we should try and get our arms around this overall tobacco use, Dr. Fellows. And I appreciate your bringing this testimony forward. I guess I have two questions. Number one, are there any other associated health problems for those folks that quit smoking? I understand that some folks who quit smoking go to nibbling. Care for us?
Well, one of the things in developing the model, and this model that I developed was we used the medical records over a six-year period for 200,000 adult Kaiser Permanente members in the Northwest. In 1999 alone, of the people who quit smoking, and largely they quit on their own, 40% of them had a smoking-related disease diagnosis. And people who quit on their own tend to quit because of a health condition. And the costs during that time are staggering. That quarterly costs, total costs for those folks in 1999 who quit on their own were about $9,000 in one calendar quarter per person.
Mr. Chair, I'm really looking for the associated other ancillary health issues. I was thinking more in line of gaining weight and those kinds of issues.
heart disease. Yeah, preventing quitting smoking has been shown to reduce the risk of death from heart disease by about half in the first 2 years. There is some transitory or at least some small increase in weight that's associated, I think, with quitting. But the bigger issue, is for people who are smoking, is that smoking actually ends up now leading to the excess weight gain and increasing their risk for sedentary lifestyle. So it's really important to focus on the front end of what causes weight gain and sedentary lifestyle. And one of those is that they pick up smoking when they're teenagers.
I guess in that regard, Mr. Chair, I come back to where Mazin was taking us back to the 20s, and that is that what would it look like in Oregon if we've got these significant health care benefits, $160 million a year in terms of today's dollars and future dollars, and savings just from the 22,000 people that quit smoking by raising the tobacco tax, what we're talking about here. I guess I would look at why shouldn't we be passing legislation today that says consumption of tobacco in Oregon should be illegal? Making it absolutely illegal to use tobacco in the state of Oregon, and then use general funds to fund an aggressive non-smoking campaign.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I would refer you to those who passed the original prohibition amendment and those then who repealed it later. Other questions for Dr. Fellows? I have one, if I may, and then we're going to adjourn because we're running out of time for today. I think I understood you to say earlier that there are insurance companies and health treatment organizations that make substantial bets based on your estimates. Not on this matter, but on other things. Did I understand that correctly?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well,
the question, Chair.
That you work for health insurance plans and others that who rely upon your estimates among other people's estimates to help them do their underwriting.
Well, no, I don't. I'm not a Representative Barhart.
I'm glad I asked the question then.
Yeah, I'm not a. I'm a health economist, and yes. I do population level research. My former life prior to coming back to Portland, where I grew up, was in the Office on Smoking and Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was the person who oversaw the research on the disease burden of smoking. And that would be the 440,000 annual deaths and the $157 billion in annual costs nationwide. And then I wrote most of did the research that provided the data for Oregon and for other states. And what I have been doing at Center for Health Research in a main focus was to take the next step and to try to assess, well, what would be the downstream impact of actually devoting time and money to get helping people quit. And I started that effort with this analysis of healthcare member data and then using the best available evidence to project what would happen if the health plan actually actively sought and promoted quitting among its members and how that might work. From that research, we've put into the public realm a calculation tool along as a web-based calculation tool that other health plans and other organizations have used. I've helped the state of Texas evaluate their tobacco control program and then several businesses that have also done so as well.
But do you have a URL for us on that?
Yes, it's in there.
It's in your testimony.
Yes, it is.
So your testimony, you're actually, your background is very much on point for the kind of testimony you're giving today.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this witness? Thank you very much, Dr. Fellows. We appreciate your being here this afternoon. I apologize to the others who we did not get to. I hope that you can come back tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and we will continue our public hearing on House Bill 2201. And with that, the Committee on Revenue is adjourned for today.